So Sam tells me that this is special episode number 6, and in this special episode, we're going to be talking about 2009, which is the year that was. I guess we'll just go ahead and kind of go over it from the beginning of the year and talk about all the various movies that came out, what we liked, what we didn't like, what trends we saw, interesting things to talk about. So maybe we should start off with...
Introducing yourself, maybe?
Ooh. Well, yeah, look, I'm Stephen Keller.
I'm Sam Stoddard.
Yeah.
All right, we got that out of the way.
In case you were unclear, who was who?
That'll catch the one person who had started listening to us with this episode.
It's important. So let's see here. Should we talk about 2009 by talking about 2008 first?
No, I actually want to talk about 2009 by talking about 2010 first.
Okay.
If I may, because I have to get this story out. It sort of relates to 2009 because it involves one of the producers of Transformers 2. And I just want to say, this would maybe be the most fun sentence I've ever said in my life. Don Murphy, one of the producers of the Transformers movies, emailed me a lolcat. Isn't that cool?
A lolcat.
A lolcat. If you don't know what those are, it's this internet fad where people take funny pictures of the cats and put these captions on them. And they're called lolcats. Yeah, so, I mean, this is... I'm not kidding, though. Don Murphy. Strange... apparently he's a real jerk or something. And if you are
a big Hollywood
producer...
He's going to find this. He's going to hear this.
And, that's right. He's going to send me another lolcat. Apparently if you're a big Hollywood producer, like if you've just made the biggest moneymaker of 2009, if you don't count Avatar, and then, you know... What you have to do with your time at that point is to troll message boards on the internet and make fun of people. So there's this one that I read, and he's on there periodically, apparently only to tell people things like how their mothers didn't love them and how they don't know anything or have useful lives. And it's kind of juvenile. But, finally I was watching this happen, and I said something like,
Here's what Sam actually posted. He says, "Don, you're worth, what, $2 billion? And being snarky at anonymous people in a blog is what you can think of to do with your time? That's either the most unambitious thing I've ever heard of, or the most unimaginative. I'm not sure which."
Okay, so I said that. Just seemed like the thing to do. So less than 5 or 10 minutes later, it was not more than 10 minutes later, I checked my email, and I see an email from Don Murphy. What? Oh, no. What's this about? So I open it up. There's no text. There's just a picture of a lolcat. It's this cat with its mouth open comically wide, and the caption is, "Lol, lol, lol, what?" And that was it. Actually, the subject line said something like, my eyes, and I went to back to the blog, and he posted something about how he clicked on the link that was in my name, went to my website, rinkworks.com, if you were curious, and and said, this terrible web design, it hurts my eyes. Which is kind of funny, because it's kind of what I said after I saw Transformers 2, but...
Zing. Yeah. I've been telling you, you're treading on thin ice here. He's going to send you more emails.
I know. Well... It's just great, because it brings so many images to mind. Like, I'm vaguely aware that he did not get along at all with Michael Bay, and they would be fighting over what to do in the movie, and Michael Bay would tend to win those arguments. But now I know why. It's because, if he just sends him lolcats as his part of the argument, I could just picture Michael Bay there with a cell phone. Oh, another lolcat. Well, I'm still doing it my way.
I'm confused about the whole situation, because, he's a big-shot Hollywood producer. Shouldn't he be busy, doing coke and hanging out with strippers at clubs? I mean, is he, on his iPhone from the club, sending you lolcats? How does that work?
It's either that or off the back of his yacht, I would hope. I would hope it's not in a dumpy apartment somewhere. It's just, you gotta know how to act the part if you're gonna be a big Hollywood producer.
I think so, yeah. All right. So,
He sent me a lolcat. Hey, if you come to our website, allmovietalk.com, I will post the picture of the lolcat that Don Murphy, producer of the Transformers films, emailed me.
Telling you, man, you're bringing the heat down on us. We're going to get perhaps one or even two more lolcats sent to our emails here.
Well, I know. It's a big risk.
Don't involve me in your fight with Don Murphy, your feud with... okay.
let's talk about 2008.
Sure. So, want to talk about the Oscars for 2008, which actually happened, I guess, in 2009. Always confusing. So, let's see here. Did some movies won? What was that? Slumdog something? One best...
Slumdog Millionaire, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, what was up with that? Now, this is a director... Who's the director of this guy? Danny Boyle?
Danny Boyle, yeah. The director of... like Trainspotting,
and
28 Days Later.
Would you consider him to be an overdue director, or a worthy winner, or what?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I like Danny Boyle well enough. I'm not a huge fan, I guess. I thought Slumdog Millionaire was okay. I didn't think it was that special.
So what was it about Slumdog Millionaire that suddenly made... A lot of people said this. They're like, yeah, I love Danny Boyle, but... why is he being awarded for this movie?
Yeah, this seems strange.
I don't know. It's got an unusual structure to it. It's about a kid who grows up in the slums of India, and he finds his way onto the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, the Indian version of that, and winds up winning $1 million, hence Slumdog Millionaire. But the interesting structure is that, you know, he's asked a question, and then there's a flashback to an earlier part of his life, which explains how he came to know the answer.
It's actually,
so that's interesting.
It's actually more complicated than that, because he's actually being interrogated by police about how he knew the answer. So in the police interrogation, they flash back to him on the game show, which then flashes back to parts in his life that explains how he... I mean, it's like a couple layers going on there.
Yeah, so that
actually,
part
pretty
of it,
clever.
The structure is very interesting. The story, I don't know, I like... parts of it a lot, and other parts are just kind of filler. I don't know.
That tends to happen. That's about right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it felt a lot like City of God.
Really?
Which I thought in terms of it's, you know, kind of a look in that. It had that kind of same really kind of kinetic energy to it about kids growing up in a slum. They looked kind of similar. Obviously, you know, City of God is taking place outside of Rio de Janeiro, and this is taking place in India, so... different locales, but I thought they had similar sorts of vibes about, you know, a kid who's growing up in these really hard conditions and still kind of ends up being a decent person, whereas, you know, his friend or in City of God or his brother in Slumdog Millionaire gets, you know, the gangster lifestyle. I don't know, just some broad similarities.
Yeah, I guess you see your point, but boy, what a difference in outlook between the two. Slumdog is kind of a feel-good movie. I mean, it's got some not-so-feel-good parts to it.
Yeah.
But I think it's ultimately optimistic, and City of God, definitely not. I think the point there is that, you know, if you escape, you're a lucky one, but the system of depravity and violence is not going to end.
I think maybe City of God is perhaps a little more realistic look at those kinds of... Whereas, I mean, Slumdog Millionaire is deliberately kind of a fable or a fairy story. It kind of drops realism in the second act, and second and third acts, really.
Yeah. But, you know, I liked it.
Yeah, it was fine. I don't dislike it. It was just kind of weird as a Best Picture choice, but...
Right. So, what about the Best Animated Feature choice, which would be WALL-E? Pixar wins again.
Yeah, better than Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah, I thought it was spectacular.
Agreed.
The idea of the movie is that there's this robot who's apparently the only thing left working in the world. There's no people around, not really... any other robots either. It's just this one robot who is apparently programmed to clean up the trash, and he's left running, and the planet is otherwise abandoned. And so the first, you know, I would say hour of the movie or something like that, not really any dialogue, and just kind of episodic explorations of this world, which is fascinating. And then it winds up going in a very different direction in the second half. Some people liked it, some people didn't. Some people were thought it was kind of a jarring shift to suddenly be in outer space and encountering other things. And you finally do get an explanation of what happened to the world. And it's also a love story, as strange as that sounds, because this robot is visited by another robot who can... do you know, really fancy things, but is also maybe a little dangerous, and it defies description, really. You know, hearing myself describe it, I would not be interested in seeing it. But it's not hard to figure out that Pixar knows how to put a lot of warmth and humanness into their stories, and they do that here for sure.
Right. Well, this movie was supposed to be a huge flop, according to the pundits, before its release.
Yeah.
Just like every other Pixar movie.
Kids wouldn't sit still for it. That's one of the things they were saying.
And yet everyone loved it, so.
Exactly.
This is really why you shouldn't even bother judging Pixar movies until you've seen them, because
right.
they're able to take the strangest premises and execute them really, really well.
Exactly. So what do you think about that tonal shift, though, in the middle? Is that a flaw in the movie? Or
no, not at all. I think we'll talk about Up in a moment here. I think Up's shift in storyline to end in the third act is quite a bit more jarring than the Wall-E shifts.
But it's funny, because in Up, it's more of a gradual shift.
That's true.
It's like it's not all of a sudden I'm in a different kind of movie. But otherwise, I agree with you. It's a little bit... See, the thing about Wall-E is that even though you don't see the shift coming and it feels weird, if you reflect back on the themes of the movie from the beginning, it all fits together. And it is logically where that story would lead. Or at least, you know, it's an ending that does justice to the first half. You might like the first better than the second, or vice versa. But the two are linked thematically.
Now let's see here. We also had The Dark Knight that year and Heath Ledger's posthumous Oscar for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah, and it controversially didn't get a Best Picture nomination, which may have led to the Academy opening up the field to 10 nominees this year. Because they say, hey, you know, people aren't going to watch our show if we're going to omit things like The Dark Knight, which are really popular. So if we expand it to 10 nominees, then we can say, hey, we nominated these popular movies as well as these.
Right, and then we'll give the Best Picture Oscar to the movie that made $1 million.
To the
psych audiences.
And it was kind of funny. But yeah, Heath Ledger won a posthumous Oscar for The Joker, and weren't we even predicting that? There was talk about that. Like,
yeah,
right
there
when
was.
He died.
And I think he died before the movie obviously came out, and it was sort of like, oh, there's no way, and just internet fanboy talk. And it turns out we all saw the movie and we're like, you know what, yeah, I guess maybe he does deserve it.
Yeah. Now, if he hadn't died, would he have still won?
Oh, I don't know. So the supporting actor award is always so oddly hard to... I mean, it tends to go to really weird performances, so maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I asked that question because it's interesting to think about, but it is impossible to answer and foolish to try, but... You know, it is interesting to think about how the, you know, what goes into determining who wins these things. It's not simple. But certainly Ledger, you know, whether he would have won or not, is a worthy winner. That is an amazing performance, and it is actually quite nice to see the Academy honoring something like a superhero movie in this way.
Agreed, especially a very good superhero movie.
There's another interesting category. Best Actress went to Kate Winslet for The Reader, and she wasn't expected to be nominated for that movie, but for Revolutionary Road. I don't know, everybody seemed to have a different opinion about which one was better. Well, I guess there's only two possible opinions. But nobody, people couldn't seem to agree on which one was better, but they did seem to agree that neither one was her career best work. But, you know, I, so what? They were great performances, and I've wanted her to win an Oscar for a long time. She's clearly one of the best actresses working today and has done great work. I think this was her sixth nomination or something like that.
Yeah, I think before last year I would have put money that she had won an Oscar, in fact.
Really?
Felt like she'd won at least two before that, right?
Well, maybe that's why she hadn't won. It's people like, oh yeah, she's won before.
That's very possible.
But yeah. Amazing. And The Reader is a very good movie. She plays basically an ex-Nazi on trial for war crimes. But the movie is not just about her personal story, but also about sort of this more national feeling of, you know, trying to cope with what has happened in Germany's past and dealing with the Holocaust on the nation's conscience. So it's kind of a heavy movie, and not necessarily an inspiring one. It's just, hey, some terrible things happened, and, you know, there's not a good way to fix it. I mean, you can't fix it. There's only how do we move on? And that's an interesting question to see dealt with.
Okay, yeah, that... I haven't actually seen it, but...
Okay. Well,
doesn't sound like a super great recommendation, or you liked it or not.
I liked it a lot, but I don't think it's a movie I would watch again either. It's just, you know, it's not something you watch for entertainment, but it is a pretty compelling drama. So I mentioned a moment ago how Danny Boyle was honored for a movie that most people wouldn't consider one worth honoring him for. Might the same be true of David Fincher, whose The Curious Case of Benjamin Button won a lot of tech awards and was nominated for picture? What do you think?
I really liked Benjamin Button while I was watching it. It didn't necessarily age that well in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But I also love Fincher quite a bit.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess it didn't really work out for him exactly, in terms of he still didn't really have an Oscar, but...
Do you agree with the assessments of some people are saying that this is like Forrest Gump with a twist on how the character ages?
I mean, I guess a little. I definitely see the correlations, but I don't know. I mean, they feel different, and there's not nearly as much of the, oh, Benjamin Button runs into a famous person kind of stuff as there was in Forrest Gump, which is kind of grating, especially... You know, a little bit removed from it. But yeah, I definitely see it. It worked for me while I watched it, again, but it just, when I think, the more I think about it, the less it holds up, I think.
There are movies that are like that, too. It's kind of strange. I remember you talking recently somewhere about American Beauty, which I think we both loved at the time. And,
right.
You know, 10 years on, 12 years on, thinking back on it, it doesn't seem as smart and amazing as it must have been.
Yeah, it's odd. Well, I mean, for me, the Benjamin Button shine wore off the instant I saw the light outside the theater, so...
I hate it when that happens to me. Yeah,
didn't quite last very long.
No, this lasted longer than that for me. I know what you're saying. I still like it, though.
Yeah, I think I do, too.
Absolutely amazing visual effects, because when you watch it, keep in mind that I don't think Brad Pitt appears in, like, the first hour of the movie or something. The character's there, but... I'd have never guessed it was CGI, and that's one of the very few times that CGI special effects have not been conspicuously computer-generated.
Agreed.
So, yeah, that leads in, as I say, to the Academy Awards for 2009, which took place earlier this year, and there was a switch to 10 nominees, and, you know, there's a lot of speculation. Well, are we going to nominate 10 art house dramas instead of 5, or are we actually going to get a good mix in there? And I think the experiment worked. I mean, we had Up in there, an animated movie for only the second time ever. District 9, definitely not a contender would have been playing in a 5-wide field. And The Blind Side as well, same deal there. And those are all appealing to different audiences, but all popular.
Right. On the other hand, again, a very sort of traditional Best Picture winner won it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you're not going to change who the winner is, I guess. And I'm not sure that you'd want to, but we'll get to that later. So what happened, never mind awards, what other kind of movies happened in 2009? Like, one of the first big ones was Watchmen. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, have we not talked about Watchmen previously? Maybe we
No,
haven't.
I don't think so.
Okay. So I'm a huge fan of the comic book it's based on. I think you read the comic too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think I convinced you after years of badgering. And I was a little nervous about the movie. I think we both were. We may have talked about that. The trailer just seemed all kinds of wrong with weird slow-mo action. And...
Yeah, and the guy who made it was the guy who made 300, which is...
Oof.
You know, completely the wrong kind of... You wouldn't exactly call 300 an intelligent movie. I mean, it's pretty much pure visceral adrenaline and nothing.
Correct.
Nothing else. I mean, absolutely nothing else.
That's
I hated that movie.
I didn't hate it, but I guess, I mean, it was, I guess, at least effective at delivering pure adrenaline, if that's all you wanted.
I'm not sure it was, though, because I wasn't feeling adrenaline. I was just feeling kind of bored by all the movement. And you know, if I cared about any person in the movie, then, you know, I might have been more caught up in it. But I kind of see what you mean. It does have a visual style that... you can't really ignore it. Is an
right.
accomplishment in that respect,
and certainly it excited people the way that an average action movie doesn't. I mean, it definitely has its following, and the people who like it really really like it. So I'll give it that. It's not like, you know, Transformers 2, which made $3 billion and nobody on the planet seems to care about. really, it's weird. But well, Watchmen was almost overly faithful to the source material. In a lot of weird ways. I mean, it felt like they used the comic just as the storyboards for the film, sort of similar to how Sin City had been done before. And yet, I don't know why. It doesn't really work.
In some ways, it's a very cinematic comic because it uses a lot of movie-like cinematography. There'd be a succession of panels that are like a pan out or a track out or something like that, so you could translate into a camera move. But then there's all kinds of things that don't really, translate at all. It's very tied in with the comic medium. Like there'd be, I remember lots of times there would be two scenes unfolding simultaneously, and every other panel would be, you know, one would be one from the other, but the narration would all be from one of the two scenes, not alternating.
Right.
And yet that dialogue would also have an indirect comment on the other scene. So how do you do that in a movie? That's a comic language. That's not something you can express in film grammar that I know of.
Yeah, I think that's sort of probably a big part of the problem is that one of the reasons Watchmen is such a celebrated comic is because it took all this language of comics and took it to a new level. And then, when you try and bring that to the movie, you can get the story, you can get the look, but you miss all of that interesting juxtaposition. And, you know, they had a, for the theatrical release of Watchmen, they had to cut a lot of the sort of side stuff and the weird, interesting little tiny characters in the margins and these weird, there's a whole comic within a comic that ends up talking about the action indirectly, and that all kind of had to go. I guess there's a 4-hour long DVD release. It's got everything from the comic, like, ever put into the movie. Including the comic within the comic put back. Anyway, I haven't seen that yet. Maybe it plays better, but I kind of doubt it. Let's see here. What else was there? Well, another thing that happened early in that year that was kind of a... we should mention real quickly is that Luc Besson turned on his machine that produces slick European thrillers and turned out Taken, which I think was the number one movie through, like, January, February, and March. It just seemed like it never stopped making money.
Yeah. Have you seen it?
I have.
What do you think?
It's a Luc Besson slick European thriller. I don't know. I guess it's fine. It's exactly what it tries to be and nothing more.
I saw that too. I'm not sure what to make of it, really. I'm tempted not to like it, but I sort of had a good time. So what does that say? I don't know.
That's how I was.
It's weird.
Look, the movie is Liam Neeson going around killing the hell out of dudes, all right? If that sounds good to you, then that's the movie. If you're going to go in and expect character or story, you're not going to get it. But it looks slick, and it's fine.
I was surprised at how well he plays that kind of tough guy, you know, the super cool, extremely competent guy.
It's sort of basically Jack Bauer the movie. So
true, that's a good... well...
without nearly all the twists.
Yeah, without all the twists or you know, content.
Right. Right. It's just if you took the action and torture scenes from 24 and put them into a movie.
Right.
Which I guess we'll be getting with 24, the movie, you know, in a year or two.
Right. Can't wait. So that, I guess, takes us into the summer. What did you think about the summer of 2009?
I wish I could think about it, but I've forgotten almost all of those movies.
Okay, well, I have a list here, and
okay,
maybe
good.
I can prod your memory by going through. I've got them categorized.
Okay.
So the first category is unusually noisy.
No.
And, of course, those movies would be like G.I. Joe, which, you know, I don't think either one of us has seen, so we won't bag on it too much. But apparently it was just nonstop pieces of shrapnel flying around. And similarly, also Transformers 2, which we've ragged on a lot. But let's take another moment to trash it.
Again, I kind of liked Transformers. It wasn't a great movie by any... I mean, so far from it. But for dumb summer action movies, that was kind of fun. It was too long, and there's too much... many subplots, but I like Shia LaBeouf. I like the graphics. There are giant robots fighting. Transformers 2 was just incomprehensible. What? Oh my gosh. Did you understand anything?
No, not really. The beginning of it, where they actually have a couple of the humans talking instead of just the robots bashing into each other. Yeah, those were... it reminded me of the beginning of Armageddon, where Bruce Willis is supposedly comically running around an oil rig shooting at Ben Affleck, ooh, which is one of the most embarrassing scenes ever shot. It is so terrible. People don't behave that way, and
right,
it's not funny to exaggerate and speculate. It's just, and it was that same thing. And coincidentally, another Michael Bay movie, right? Or maybe not so coincidentally.
There's a part in Transformers 2 where the actress playing Shia LaBeouf's mom accidentally eats some pot brownies and gets high and behaves like nobody on the planet has ever behaved when they got high. Also, I like the notion that this woman who, you know, I'm going to guess, grew up in the 60s or 70s, has no clue what marijuana is. Like, she's completely, like, what is this substance? It's awesome. Boy. All right, what else?
That's just one example of many terrible things. But then, I don't know if you saw 2012. I didn't.
I did not.
Okay, so, but, you know, again, that was a little better received, I guess, depending on who you talk to, but it did also seem to be like another culmination in just going over the top with special effects, like every possible thing being destroyed that could be possibly in any movie ever is in 2012. So the question is, you know, how much further can you go? I mean, can you get bigger and louder and noisier and you know, more spectacular and explosive and whatever than Transformers 2 in 2012? I mean, is that even possible? I'm not even talking about and make a good movie, because we're beyond that. But is it even possible to do?
You know what it makes me think of is how naive everyone was back in, like, the late 80s and early 90s, writing about how loud, dumb action movies were. Like, imagine if you were a critic making fun of, like, Die Hard 3 or something. Like, oh, this is just nonstop action. It's so stupid. It's like, oh, no. Just wait another 15 years. We'll show you stupid.
Yeah.
But, you know what? It's why I guess I kind of like movies like Taken, because at least they're action movies that have plots that I can follow. I mean, it's not really much of a plot. Liam Neeson wants his daughter back, and he has to kill guys to get her. But at least I know what's going on, and I know who the characters are, and I can follow the action sequences.
Yeah.
Is that so wrong to ask, that you make a movie with characters that I at least know their names?
Excellent, yeah. Okay, so what I'm worried about, though, is that now every movie is going to be in 3D, so
There's
a whole new dimension for explosions to happen in.
It's perfect, too, because we'll have Transformers 3D.
Yeah.
It just fits in beautifully.
Isn't it? All right, so how about some other disappointments that are maybe in other genres? Not really other genres, I guess. There's still in the action genre. We have The Taking of Pelham 123, that remake with Denzel Washington and John Travolta, and then we had the Wolverine prequel early in the year, and then we had Terminator Salvation. Any good ones there?
I didn't see Pelham, the remake. Did you?
No, that wasn't any good either.
Okay.
Yeah, it was very uninspired.
Wolverine wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. Is that a compliment?
No, because it depends on what you thought.
Well, I thought it was going to be just abysmal, and it was only, you know, bad.
Okay, that's still bad. What about Terminator?
Terminator. I'm of two minds here. I think, on the one hand, I guess it's, if I can somehow separate it from the Terminator series and pretend like it's its own movie, I guess it's like a two-star kind of flick.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's like, okay, there's some passable action, and it's pretty stupid, but, you know, all right. It's competently made, but as a Terminator movie, we're just, what an embarrassment.
Well, I'm going to surprise you here. I liked it.
Really?
I think it was roughly the equal of the previous movie, Terminator 3. Of course, neither one of those are anywhere near as good as the first two. But yeah, I was surprised because it's directed by Mick G, who was previously my least favorite mainstream director ever. The two Charlie's Angels movies were just horrible. And the thought of him mucking with the Terminator movies, yeah, that was horrible to contemplate. And then I was surprised. I actually kind of liked it. I was into it.
Yeah. There are some good scenes in it. It has a couple of good moments, but maybe it's just hard for me to get past my expectations, but this is the movie I've been waiting for forever, right? This is the future war. This is John Connor becoming John Connor, and I just felt so underwhelming.
Yeah, well, I also think that they didn't complete that story either. I think, although the reboot is in fashion, so probably we're going to have a remake before another sequel, but I do think there's maybe two more movies left in it, in the story. You know, one of which is, hey, how do we get the 800 or whatever, back in time?
Right.
That story wasn't told, but it would be a good way, you know, to start off the next one.
I think I have a problem, too, because I've never been able to figure out what's going on between Terminators 1 and 2. Because in Terminator, like, the last-ditch effort of Skynet is to send this thing back in time, right?
Yeah.
But then the humans capture the time machine. But then in Terminator 2, the machine sends someone else back in time. So, what? How did they... did the Skynet get the machine back? I thought Skynet had been defeated. I've never been clear on that. And then Terminators, like, 2 and 3 don't even address it. So, anyway.
Well, I wouldn't hold your breath either, but it would be cool. I mean, there is the potential for the story to be completed. What about Star Trek? Because that was another series continuation that, you know, took a little different route, I guess.
Well, everyone seemed to like Star Trek, except for me.
Except for you. Wow.
I'm the only person who doesn't like that movie.
So here's my thought. It is wrong. I think these characters are too tied to the actors that play them. They're not the kind of characters like James Bond that are larger than, you know, the people that originated them. Like, you know, Inspector Clouseau would be an example of that kind of person.
Sure.
If it's not Peter Sellers, it's not Clouseau. It's somebody pretending to be Clouseau. It's like if you do a really good Elvis impersonation. Well, great, but you're not Elvis, okay? You're
right.
Just an Elvis impersonator, and I feel like at least most of the Star Trek characters that fall into that category.
Well, I get you, but and I didn't like the movie, but the one thing I did like was the performances. You know, I think Chris Pine does a good Kirk. He's not just doing a Shatner imitation.
Yeah, well, actually, I was going to say, this movie surprised me at doing it as well as it did. Although I did kind of want to warn Kirk not to trust that Vulcan because he likes to cut people's heads open and steal their powers. They did a better job than I thought, but I still think it was wrong to do it at all, and yet I liked the movie a lot. I thought it was a good story. It didn't have the intellectual content of the classic Star Trek, which is always about ideas
right. Rather
than action, but as an action sci-fi movie, I thought it was a lot of fun. Really good.
I don't like Star Trek that much, so
okay. For
them to, you know, ruin the characters, I don't care. I have no real attachment to any of those characters. They can replace them, doesn't bother me. They can do whatever they want to with the timeline, I don't care. I just thought it was kind of boring. And I didn't like the humor. Like, there was a lot of humor, and I think that's my big problem. Like, if I wasn't on its wavelength, and if you're not laughing at the jokes, the movie becomes kind of painful.
That's true. That'll happen with anything. Yeah. I know what you mean.
And I just don't... The plot really doesn't make any sense if you think about it. But whatever.
All right, so we talked about guy movies. Let's talk about chick flicks. Have you seen any of the ones that came out over the summer? There was...
No.
All right. I have. So,
does Wolverine count?
Sure, why not?
All right, I saw that one.
Okay. No, I saw The Proposal, which was a big comeback hit kind of for Sandra Bullock, and I thought that was a better-than-average romantic comedy. And then there was something that skewed a bit younger, Confessions of a Shopaholic. Again, thought it was pretty good. The leading actress has, I think, some comedic talent that I wasn't expecting to see in a movie of that kind. And just yesterday, actually, I saw The Time Traveler's Wife with Eric Bana and Rachel McAdams. And wow, that I'm not sure if that is a chick flick, actually. It might be a guy movie in disguise.
Really?
But that's a... I don't know. It sort of crosses the line. And I'm not sure if you would like it or not, because it is a bit... It has an emotional content that you're kind of averse to sometimes. But it's an interesting movie to think about. It's this guy who travels back and forth in time and can't control it. And so he'll just be walking along and suddenly, boom, he's 10 years in the past or something. And it's about his romance with this one woman who meets him first as a child when she's a child and he's an adult. But, you know, later on when she meets him... He hasn't done that yet, so he doesn't know who she is. And it's a movie that is very creative about playing with this paradox and in exploring the psychological and emotional ramifications of trying to have a relationship with somebody who is like this or trying to be that person who can't control that. And, you know, he knows things about his future that he'd rather not. And they do a lot with the idea, and it turns out to be a tremendously emotional movie. So I thought that was a great movie.
Hmm.
But, yeah, definitely not one I saw coming again. So I think the chick flicks did a lot better than the guy movies this summer.
Well, there was one guy movie that I really, really liked
okay. This
summer. That's The Hangover,
which
was unexpected hit, and is a really interesting comedy in that it works on like three kind of different levels. There's a really interesting mix of humor, which I think is why it made so much money. When you make kind of a what appears to be like a frat guy comedy, but you have crazy indie comic Zach Galifianakis in one of the leads, like, you know, you're doing something different. So it's a movie, probably half people listening to this have already seen it, but the basic premise is these guys go to Vegas for a bachelor party, they get way too smashed, they wake up the next morning, remember nothing of the night before, and the bachelor is missing, and no one can find him. And so then it becomes sort of this interesting movie where they're going around Vegas trying to piece together what happened the previous night. And the structure is really cool because they never really flash back. Like, you think in this movie, oh, we keep flashing back, but they don't do that. So you just get to see all the aftermath as these guys try to figure it out. And what makes it really funny is if you watch it more than once, the structure really pays off, because once you know how everything fits together to see it all from the beginning, it's surprisingly clever and also is, I think, pretty hilarious, so that works.
Wow, so you're telling me I have to see that?
I would recommend it, yeah. Sometimes we don't agree comedically, so you may or may not enjoy it, but it's an interesting movie and it does a good job. As somebody who loves Vegas, it does a pretty good job of capturing that city.
Okay. All right, moving on. We missed talking about the continuation of the Harry Potter saga.
Oh.
So we had part 6 over the summer called Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that book was, I guess, my favorite until the one after that.
Ugh.
Snape is my favorite character, and I loved the way that story dealt with Snape. But I can kind of tell by your groaning over there that you weren't thrilled with the movie.
These are just getting worse, man. I have no faith in part 7.5 or whatever the heck they're doing. I mean, each Harry Potter movie, except for the third, is a little bit worse than the ones before it, right?
No.
No?
No, because
really?
Part 4 is the second best.
Is it?
Movie. Yes.
No.
I think 3 and 4 are almost equal. 3 is
what?
Better, but yeah.
Yeah, man. What universe are you watching these movies in? 1 and 2 are definitely better than anyway.
No. The Chris Columbus one?
We can agree. 6, no good, right?
Yeah, actually we are. 6 is... Well, 5 and 6... I'm surprised to be having this conversation because I thought you were defending 5 and 6.
Well, no, I think what I said is...
In fact, I think if I go back to a previous All Movie Talk episode, you'll be sticking up for it when I'm down on it. I don't know.
I think I admitted that 5 was the weakest of the movies, but not that horrible.
Oh, I thought it was horrible.
Six, horrible.
Yeah. I might even like 6 a little bit better than 5, but it doesn't really matter because I did not like either one of them. And I think the problem is... Well, the problem with number 5 was that the director followed the story, but he didn't really know how to pace it. It's the longest book and the shortest movie. And, you know, there's certain key emotional scenes that just need to breathe to work. Like when Ron Weasley's father is attacked and might be dying, you need to give Ron a moment to ingest that information and react to it. I mean, this is a big deal, right? The movie just blows past and you just kind of see him in the background. You don't even know he's part of the story. I thought 6 was an improvement in that respect because I don't think it felt quite as mechanical, but definitely it's a letdown because it didn't seem to understand the story it was telling. Like in the book, you know, the title is Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, and the book has this, you know, rather lengthy mystery that it keeps coming back to. Who is the Half-Blood Prince? Well, he's the former owner of a textbook with some interesting things written in it that turned out to be smarter than what's in the printed material of the textbook. So who is this genius that used to own this book and maybe has kind of a dark side to his personality? Well, that's a big mystery in the movie. It's like, yeah, the Half-Blood Prince used to own this textbook. And by the way, at the end, you know, I am the Half-Blood Prince. Well,
yeah.
So? Ugh. What? Who cares? What does that mean? I don't know what that means. I know the story, and I don't know what that means anymore. I gotta go read the book again. Here's another weird thing. Movies of books tend to amp up the action and stuff. The action scenes
right.
are, you know, more visual. You can get a more exciting scene, a more visually exciting scene, and you have control of the pacing, so you can use that control of the pacing, which you don't have when you are writing a book, to make a big battle scene. The end of the movie, like, took that out? I don't understand. It's like the great flight from Hogwarts in the book was just, let's walk out across the lawn. It was so weird. It just didn't have the energy in the right places.
It just felt really lazy.
Yeah.
They weren't really trying anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I don't want to talk about this anymore.
Okay, good.
It depresses me thinking about it.
Let's just move on, then.
All right.
Let's move on to the animated movies of 2009. Maybe we'll see a better thing here. What do you think of the animation of 2009?
I haven't watched enough, but I really, really need to. Obviously, I loved Up, and everyone on the planet seems to agree that Coraline and Ponyo are brilliant. And also, I've heard some really great things about Fantastic Mr. Fox. So I've really got to catch up on my Blu-ray watching here.
Oh, so you haven't seen really any of those except Up?
Up, yeah, Up's the one.
Okay, so I'll take this one for you. All right. Yes, 2009 was a brilliant year for animation. Usually lucky to get one good animated movie a year. We had three. And you named them. Up, Ponyo, and Coraline were all just brilliant movies. And I would also say that, you know, you named the fourth as well, Fantastic Mr. Fox. I would definitely put in a tier below those three. But it was also a very good movie. And stylistically, really, really neat. Kind of an abstract style, intentionally primitive-looking stop-motion animation. It was great to see, experimentation with visual styles. I haven't seen The Princess and the Frog, but, you know, it sounds like that was also a good movie, and it's also nice to see them actually making 2D movies again, because, you know, I have nothing against the 3D ones, but, I kind of miss the old style as well. And, you know, different styles are suitable for different stories. But then even like the next tier down, the movies that you expect to be maybe passably entertaining and not much more, even most of those were stronger than you'd expect. Like Ice Age 3 was a better movie than at least the previous one, probably better than the first one too. You know, and it wasn't a great movie, but it was a lot of fun, and it made a ridiculous amount of money, like almost $1 billion worldwide, which is, by comparison, Lord of the Rings movies made almost $1 billion and maybe slightly over. How did that happen? I have no idea. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs looked like this cheap little kiddie knockoff. Actually, it was a lot of fun. Nine wasn't that great, but it was a great idea. Monsters vs. Aliens, you know, that was okay, but I've seen worse DreamWorks movies. One good one that came out on video, I don't think it was in theaters, was A Matter of Loaf and Death, which is another Wallace and Gromit short film. Loved that a lot. So, yeah, great year for animation. Ponyo, what is it about Miyazaki? There's something about him and his animated movies that get across a feeling with characters that I'd never seen anybody else do. He kind of specializes in these fantastic creatures that are compelling because they're quiet and don't really express themselves too much. Their facial expressions are very limited, but they speak a lot ultimately through their actions. In especially American movies, you know, the way to create a memorable character is to go just completely over the top and as over the top as you can. Think of Roger Rabbit, you know, just to pick one out of a hat. Get it? A hat pulling the rabbit out of the... Anyway. But Ponyo, you know, my wife doesn't really like anime, hasn't really seen Miyazaki before, always looks over when I'm watching one and thinks, oh, that looks weird. I had Ponyo on, and she kept looking over, and finally she's like, okay, I'm just going to sit down and watch this. So, you know, it says something that even somebody who's not predisposed to like anime found this a really interesting story and just had to watch it. So, yeah, great year for animation.
Sounds like it. One other great, well, not great, but fun summer movie, which should really have been released in the fall, unclear why it came out in the summer, was Drag Me to Hell, which seems like such an obvious movie to release around Halloween. But this was Sam Raimi taking a break from making gigantic Spider-Man movies and kind of going back to his roots to make a fun, ridiculous, gross-out horror movie. So if you like the old Sam Raimi horror stuff, like the Evil Deads and the Armies of Darkness, or Army of Darkness. I guess they didn't make a sequel that they should have. I thought Drag Me to Hell was fun. Not a great movie, but really good popcorn, gross-out horror flick with some nice twists.
So some people were upset by the fact that it was rated PG-13 because they thought that the edge that Raimi had with his earlier horror films would be taken off. What do you think about that?
I saw the unrated version on DVD, so I don't really know what was different. It certainly didn't seem... There was no tree from Evil Dead sequence for sure. maybe the PG-13 version was quite a bit different. I'm not sure. Again, I don't think it was when I know about the differences. I think it worked okay. I mean, it's still pretty gross out.
Huh.
And it wasn't trying to be the crazy Evil Dead stuff. It was. It's funny if you watch the Raimi stuff, especially like Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness. It's as much slapstick comedy as it is anything else.
Yeah. Well, not the first one.
Yeah, not the first one. But the second two, they're Three Stooges as much as they're horror movies, so...
Yeah.
And this kind of goes in a similar vein. I mean, this one is actually, like, scarier than Army of Darkness, which is not at all a horror movie.
All right, so let's pick a movie from summer that kind of transitions us to the holiday slash Oscar movies at the end of the year. It was called The Hurt Locker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So this actually is an action movie, right? It's kind of a war movie, action movie?
Sort of. Maybe more of thriller.
Thriller? Okay.
It's not really... Still.
I mean, if I say it's a war movie about Iraq... then that's going to give you completely the wrong idea. Why? Because I think if you say Iraq, you're automatically thinking about political controversy. This doesn't really have that. If you remember other Iraq movies, and you probably don't because nobody saw them, but if you do, you know, they're mostly these kind of pretentious moralizing things, you know, that I don't think conservatives want to hear that, and I think liberals are like, tired of it too. Nobody wants to hear it, and that's borne out in the box office receipt of these movies. I don't think there has been a successful one yet. But I was thinking about why that might be, and I think I hit upon the reason, and that would be that it's too early to have these movies. If you think back over the 1900s and how wars of the 1900s are reflected in the movies, you realize that only World War II had well-received movies made about it earlier than about 10 years after it ended. And what makes World War II different is that it was a pretty popular war. I mean, nobody wanted to live through it, but it had a broad base of support. And, you know, people believed in what we were doing. You know, certainly, you know, the Nazis were bad, and most people figured that out. So we saw that as a war worth having. For the Vietnam War, a lot less popular. The Iraq War, a lot less popular. World War I, a lot less popular. And in all those other cases, you don't really see successful or well-received, anyway, movies made about those wars, you know, until about 10 years after they end. So what's different about World War II? As I said, it was a popular war, but also the movies made about it were champions of the war, heroes, and the war effort. And whereas if you think about Vietnam or World War I, those movies about those were largely anti-war movies. So, you know, if people are enduring a war, do they really want to go to something that tells them how horrible the war is? Well, no, they don't want to be reminded about that. So that may have a lot to do with their receptiveness to the World War II movies as opposed to the others.
Really, if you look at, like, Vietnam, you didn't really have movies made about Vietnam during Vietnam.
Right.
For the most part, it was...
Right, but then all of a sudden, like in the late 70s, you had The Deer Hunter and Coming Home, and then mid-80s Platoon and stuff like that. But earlier than that, they're not there.
Exactly. There aren't... I mean, The Deer Hunter is 78. That's several years after the Vietnam conflict, which lasted a long time.
Right.
And ended.
Yeah.
So...
And then even World War I movies. I mean, one of the biggest early ones would be All Quiet on the Western Front in 1930. So, you know, that's, what, 12 years after it ended? And so I think what's happening is these movies about the Iraq War are being made too soon, and that's why nobody's going to see them, because they're just not ready.
Also, a lot of them aren't any good.
Yeah, well, that too.
Probably worth mentioning.
But The Hurt Locker is a great movie, and still nobody saw it, right?
True.
I think it just barely made $20 million, and only after its Oscar winner. I don't even know that it has. I'm not sure. But it made, like, virtually no money when it was released in the summer, and yet it was a great movie. And not only that, it was not what you'd think of as a war movie. It was, I think it really has more of an appeal toward the summer action thriller crowd.
Yeah, definitely. But it is still, it's not a straight action thriller. I mean, there's some kind of long, extended, weirdo sequences.
Yeah, I would agree.
But definitely a very good movie.
Okay, so what else was released over the Oscar season? Well, there's that little movie called Avatar, but we talked quite extensively about that, so we probably don't need to say more. What else? The Lovely Bones by Peter Jackson. This was his long-awaited follow-up. I didn't see it yet, but I understand you have.
Yeah, it was a weird... I don't want to bag on it, because I think it was... And a lot of people did. Like, a lot of critics just kind of trashed it, which I think is unfair. But it's a really interesting attempt to make a movie and to have a really weird and cool look. But it doesn't really work because Jackson's trying to kind of... He's trying to do his Jackson thing like he did in Heavenly Creatures, to take this very serious, sort of sad, tragic story and mix it with fantasy elements to make it something else. But here he is not as successful at blending these different elements. You know, in Heavenly Creatures, they came together and got this really interesting movie with this very different texture to it. The Lovely Bones, which is about this girl who's been murdered, and then sort of from the afterlife, she's trying to help her family deal with her death, plus catch her killer. And here, you know, the sequences that are set in real life versus the fantastic sequences set in the afterlife, they feel too disconnected, like almost like different movies. But on the same time, there are some really, really tremendous, visually stunning scenes in both the real and the afterlife. And some of the acting is good, though Mark Wahlberg goes a little too much Mark Wahlberg at times, playing the father who won't let her go.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Wahlberg is strange, because we know he can do a really great job.
Yeah.
He can also do a really terrible job. Maybe it's the director that is the difference, I don't know. But you'd never guess that his performance in The Departed came from the same person that did the one in The Happening. It's beyond my ability to comprehend.
Right. And Stanley Tucci was nominated for an Oscar for his role as the killer, and he does a really nice job. As does the lead, whose name I can't pronounce, Swarze Ronan? Something like that. Swarose? She was also the little girl in Atonement, and was fantastic there, too. So,
I think it's Sorce.
Sorce, maybe.
No, I made that up. I have no idea.
Okay. Anyway, she has an unpronounceable name, but a very impressive talent as a very young actress. I think she's like 14 or 15 or something. But yeah, the movie doesn't quite work, but I don't know why people are so... Sometimes people get quick to beat up these sorts of movies. I don't get it, because at least Jackson was trying something, right?
Yeah.
Even if it fails, shouldn't we be like, well, okay, it was an interesting failure. Let's not, you know, call it a terrible movie.
Yeah, I think some of it is the weight of expectations, because a lot of people would have been waiting for The Lovely Bones for like 2-3 years, and,
sure,
you know, expecting it to be great, and if they're disappointed, then they're going to get more vicious about it, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, and there's definitely very bad moments, but there's a lot of really interesting moments, so.
What else can we talk about? Do you see the Sherlock Holmes movie?
I did. Did you see it?
No, I didn't, but...
I liked it.
I guess my dread when I saw the preview was maybe an overreaction, maybe unfounded.
I think so. I actually think, and I think both you and I are fans of the actual Doyle stories, it's not as anachronistic as the trailers kind of made it out to seem. I think part of it is that Sherlock Holmes has often been adapted in ways that are not really Sherlock Holmes, so the popular conception of him is quite a bit different than the far crazier kind of detective that we get in the original stories. You know, the Basil Rathbone portrayal is not the world's most accurate portrayal of Sherlock Holmes. Now, Robert Downey Jr.'s portrayal still has its own quirks to it, but is an interesting take that isn't as against the stories and the books as you might think it is. Yeah, there are some action scenes, and certainly the Sherlock Holmes stories aren't action stories, but we know from the stories that... Sherlock Holmes is a master of, I forget, some made-up martial art, I think, that Doyle made up. And we know that he's a bare-knuckle boxer and all this other kind of stuff. You know, Holmes wasn't supposed to be just this sort of gentlemanly detective. He was kind of a little bit of a recluse and a crazy eccentric dude who had traveled the world and been on all these adventures. And Robert Downey Jr. kind of captures that. And it's also a decent enough return to form for Guy Ritchie, who hasn't really made a good movie in a little while. You know what the big problem is that they forgot to include like a mystery that you kind of care about. So, and a Sherlock Holmes movie that I think I'm surprised that didn't get called out more, that the sort of central mystery really isn't mysterious or interesting.
Wow, Sherlock Holmes story without a mystery, excellent.
And there, I mean, there is a mystery. You just don't really care about it.
Okay.
And it's one of those things where, again, much like say Iron Man, like I think there was a plot to Iron Man. There's some sort of villain and story, but mainly what you remember is just Robert Downey Jr., and it's kind of the same way here.
Yeah. Well, we did a top six list on mysteries where the mystery isn't important, so maybe this would be a retroactive candidate for it. What else can we talk about?
I saw Invictus. It was okay. I think Clint Eastwood has become one of the most dependable directors working today, just constantly churning out pretty decent dramas. And again, Invictus is another movie that I think got unfairly beat up by some critics. I guess it's kind of cliche and by the numbers, but this story of Nelson Mandela and the South African rugby team at a very crucial juncture in that country's history is okay, yes, it kind of pulls from a couple different movie cliches, but it's still a good movie, and Freeman's portrayal of Mandela is just amazing. Part of it's because Mandela is such an amazing guy. It sounds like he's a character who's written for the movies, and yet here he comes off pretty good, and Freeman does a really good job. And if the sports stuff is just total cliche, I don't know, sometimes cliches still work. So let's see, there was another movie that was Where the Wild Things Are, which was Spike Jonze's follow-up to Adaptation and Being John Malkovich, two movies that I just love beyond all measure. So, of course, I was really excited to see a third Spike Jonze feature. This time, he's working without scriptwriter Charlie Kaufman, who we've talked about, I think, before. And, in fact, it's a script that he wrote himself with, I think, somebody else. And Where the Wild Things Are is a beautiful but incomprehensible kind of movie, I think. It looks really cool, and I kind of get what Spike Jonze is trying to do, but man, it missed me. And I just didn't really get into it. I never was on the right wavelength for it, and I kind of got the weird, whimsical, dark feeling, and I liked it, and I liked the cool look with CGI and suits and all sorts of interesting effects, but ultimately it didn't really connect with me.
Well, there's another movie from a great director that missed me, actually great directors, that would be the Coen brothers and their movie A Serious Man. We talk a lot about the Coen brothers. We're both big fans, but I don't know about this one. It's tough to tell, though, because sometimes you need to let a Coen brothers movie sit in the head, maybe watch it a second time. But yeah, I didn't really like this. It is technically proficient, I mean, as proficient as any of their movies, and has the same brutally black humor that, you know, that permeates many of their movies. Here it's a little lower key than usual, but that's fine. Exhibits the same defiance of conventional story structures that, like, say, in Barton Fink or No Country for Old Men. I love both of those movies. There's a thematic similarity, maybe, with Burn After Reading. It's not that kind of comedy, but maybe a similar theme. I like that movie, too. You know, and the similarity would be, you know, at the end of Burn After Reading, there's a character asking, well, what have we all learned? And then he can't come up with an answer. And maybe A Serious Man explores that territory, too, that just the how crazy life can be. But I didn't really connect with A Serious Man, and I think the problem is that I just didn't like the main character. I wasn't sympathetic to him. I didn't respect him. I didn't care about him. And, okay, that's not inherently problematic, but the movie, which is all about how life can get out of control, seems to expect us to empathize with his plight. And I can't, because I think that things were not entirely out of his control. You know, I kept wanting to slap him and tell him to take charge of things, which would have solved some of his problems, though definitely not all. And so my frustrations really, you know, blunted the humor for me, which would normally fit with my sensibilities. So, you know, there's definitely individual moments that sparkle in it. Just absolutely wonderful. You can tell that there are great directors making this movie, but I just found the movie as a whole kind of dull and dreary. So, yeah, kind of a disappointment for me.
I haven't seen it yet. It's high, high, high on my list of things to watch real soon.
Well, maybe we can do a follow-up when you have seen it.
I hope so.
I think whether you liked it or not, you'll have some interesting things to say about it. So we're going to go ahead and end it here. There are some movies we haven't talked about yet, and there's still some things that we want to discuss that took place in 2009, but we're going to do that next week. We're going to split it in half and have another conversation later, which will include our top six and bottom six for 2009, and we're also going to look at a couple other things that happen in the year. So check back with us in our next episode, which is probably happen in a week rather than in a month as we've been going. So we'll just crank right through the 2009 duology. So check us out at allmovietalk.com, and also check out rinkworks.com, rinkworks.com. And so see you next time.